With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Bubble, the babysitting app that helps you discover trusted local babysitters around you. They say it takes a village to raise a child. The reality in the 21st century is that most of us no longer live in a village, and if we do, our village doesn't get involved like they used to. Because being a parent is hard, and however good at it you are, you'll need a break at some point, maybe to go out for dinner with your partner, to go for a run, or to have some uninterrupted time at your computer just to get to the bottom of your emails. And that's where Bubble is a lifesaver. It makes it easy for you to find amazing childcare whenever you need it. This clever app lets you plug into your social and community networks to find sitters trusted by your friends. You can review all available sitters and see which friends you have in common. Each sitter has their identity verified and background check before their profile goes live, and every sit is tracked and insured. The best part is that you can pay your sitter easily and securely through the app at the end with no awkward fumbling for cash. So log on to Bubble. You can get more information at joinbubble.com or download the app. Just search Bubble Babysitting on App Store. And for £10 off your first booking, use the code PARENTHOOD. It's all capital letters, one word. Thanks to Bubble. Hello and welcome to The Parenthood. While being sick is a big part of childhood, I thought it would be interesting to ask the question of whether there is anything that we can do to boost our children's immunity. So with me today, I have paediatrician Dr. Sophie Niedermeyer-Patrimani, who has spent her career treating children around the world and studying how to make them better. Sophie, thank you so much for coming to join us today.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation.
I mean, on the one hand, I think being a paediatrician is an amazing job. You're healing children, but you're also around six children the whole time. Is that quite hard for you, or
it's actually a job that I really, really love, because even though children can be sick at times, they take it with so much energy, and they are so good about it. And you know, you might have a three-year-old running a fever of 39-40 degrees, and still he would run around in your office and play with the toys and be completely up to speed. So
And they're pretty good at getting better, aren't they, children?
Yes.
I mean, they do. It's probably different than if you're working in geriatrics, where it's just a little bit tougher because their bodies are new and they tend to work a little bit better than ours.
Exactly. And you don't only work with the children, but you also work with parents. So you always work in a team and everyone's trying to make them feel better. So, and in the end, they are better, as you say.
Oh, good. I think it's interesting to understand a little about the immune system before we start. I mean, children are notorious for picking up more bugs and viruses than us adults. Why is that?
It's really because the immune system of our children has to be trained and they have to be educated. It's just like they learn how to speak, they learn how to walk, and also the immune system has to learn how to work. And I like to think of the immune system as kind of our police force that we have inside ourselves. So the immune cells that we have are the brave police officers patrolling the borders and patrolling the streets and making sure that no one comes in and does any harm to us. Now, we are born with a very simple kind of immune system. That's kind of the police officers that run the streets. They know a little bit about everything. They know they would be able to pick out someone who looks a bit harmful, but they don't know specifics of any crime. So this is what babies are born with. And then once they grow older, they are exposed to all other kinds of diseases. They maybe get vaccinations. And so their immune system gets more specialized and they learn to fight more specific diseases.
I see. And so I know that babies do inherit a little bit of immunity from their mother through the placenta. And then obviously breastfeeding plays a big part, doesn't it, in terms of boosting their immunity, if that's possible?
Yes, because breast milk is this magic potion that also has a lot of enzymes and molecules that help the baby fight infection. And that's something that we just cannot provide with formula.
So obviously thinking about that, the idea of, you know, their immune system needing to be educated and needing to be exposed to various bugs and bacteria and viruses in order to become stronger, it's presumably good for them to be exposed to that.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Are we maybe guilty of keeping our houses too clean? I mean, I know that, you know, teaching antenatal classes, when people have their babies, I think it is kind of normal etiquette to wash your hands before you handle a newborn baby. And that's not because they can't cope with any illness, but it really is a pain in the neck to have that. But is it potentially quite good to bring our children up in an environment that is not pristine, that is not sprayed to an inch of its life with antibacterial spray, but in order for their immune system to mature, to expose them to a bit of dirt, a bit of bacteria? Am I right in thinking that?
Yes, I think what you're saying is you have to find the right balance. So of course you shouldn't kind of let your baby or child play in the dirt and then they come home and they lick their dirty fingers because they might pick up any kinds of stupid things. But on the other hand, yes, you can be too clean around your baby. And we've seen that children who've grown up in a very, very clean environment, they actually have a higher risk to develop allergies and asthma.
So what is the sort of ideal kind of balance? You know, do we get our children to wash their hands with antibacterial hand wash once they're sort of no longer in the baby stage, or is sort of normal soap good enough?
So I think normal soap is good enough, because what you also don't want to do is you don't want to kill the good bacteria that we have living in our skin, because these bacteria protect us from other bad bacteria. So I would also always opt for natural soaps.
And then presumably cleaning products. I mean, I remember furiously sort of going around with a kind of spray that looked quite scary in terms of how many millions of bacteria it was killing. Is that necessarily a good thing, or should we be maybe using more natural cleaning products? You know, lemon as opposed to bleach, is that quite a good thing?
Yeah. So again, in terms of killing off all the bacteria, that's really something that you don't want to do, because you want to preserve the good ones, and you want to preserve the ones that are not necessarily harmful, but that again train our immune system. So I think natural products are always better than the chemical killers. And also there are some studies that have shown that if you use chemical toxic substances, then that might lead to the irritation of the respiratory system of your child. So it actually might make your child's allergies and asthma worse without you really wanting to do that.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about sort of air quality in our homes. I mean, we've previously been obsessed with it outside, but actually people saying that actually using room sprays and cleaning sprays is not doing much good in terms of the air quality of our house.
Exactly. And that's a kind of vicious circle that parents with children who have allergies are in. They are trying to keep the house clean because they want to get rid of the dust. They want their children to be well. And then they overdo it sometimes by using room sprays and actually make everything a bit worse. So I think we need to back off a little and find the right balance there.
Because, I mean, when I think back to when my children were babies, I remember being horrified about what they'd put in their mouth. And they have this sort of instinct, don't they, that everything they have in their hand that goes to their mouth. And that's fine if it's a sort of toys of theirs or a chewing toy or something. But I remember once my son was in the park crawling around on the grass and he picked up a cigarette butt and put it in his mouth. And I thought, oh, my God, that's disgusting. But presumably there's some sort of evolutionary reason why they do that. And is that maybe them giving themselves, their immune system, the chance to sort of boost itself and go, that was disgusting, but actually now we know how to fight that disgustingness that you just put in your... And like another time, I remember my son was licking the wheels of his buggy and I just, oh my God, what's he going to come? He was fine. And he has actually turned into a very healthy little boy now. But is that potentially, you know, a sort of very primitive way of them boosting their own immune system?
It's a really nice side effect. I think they are really naturally curious, so they want to put everything in their mouth, they want to taste everything. And it seems that especially the texture and the taste of dirt seems to be very interesting to children. So I'm not sure if your children had the same, but there is a phase for every child when they are around 2 or 3 years old where they just put dirt into their mouth just because they like it. And yeah. a lot of parents freak out about it, but there's really not so many things to worry about. I mean, of course, when you say cigarette butts, it's maybe not the best choice.
We're but not advocating again, what can cigarette you do? Butts.
But on the other hand, as you say, there are a lot of bacteria in the dirt, and some of them are good, some of them are bad, but everything they do is they train our children. And if we look at this, I think we can embrace the benefits and be a bit relaxed about the rest.
I remember when Kiara, my sister, was at medical school, they showed a picture of a baby lying on the floor in a sort of, you know, stable of an animal stable. And obviously, mm-hmm. there weren't any animals treading on the baby. But the lecturer said, you know, this is good for two reasons. For a start, a child on the floor can't fall off the floor, so it's better to put them on the floor than on a surface that they can fall off. But secondly, exposure to dirt isn't a bad thing when they're little because it just helps yeah. that immune system.
And these are the revolutionary studies that we had in the 90s where people found out that children who grew up in the countryside around animals and on the farm, they actually developed a lot less allergies than children who grew up in the city in a very clean environment. And this was groundbreaking. And from then on, we really started to understand more about what causes allergies and what is the right balance between playing in the dirt and keeping it too clean.
Yeah, I remember someone once said to me, your first child eats dirt, you take them to hospital. Your second child eats dirt, you wash their mouth out. Your third child eat dirt and you're like, do they even need dinner? And actually, you do become much more relaxed. You know, I know yeah. the parents listening to us that have their first baby will be thinking, oh my God, I find this really, really difficult to listen to. But actually, you do get more relaxed. And in a way, maybe you're just getting more experienced and sort of understanding yeah. that, you know, this some kind of dirt. Yeah. And that's essentially the idea behind vaccinations, that you're giving the children's bodies a little bit of a nasty illness, you know, but not so much so that it can't tackle it, but it understands how. Because a lot of these things, once you've experienced that, once your body has experienced fighting that particular illness, mm-hmm. it knows how to do it. If you've been exposed to a certain illness, you won't get it.
Exactly, yeah.
And so I guess, you know, every cold and every kind of vomiting bug that your child has, it's not going to get that again. It's sort of banking up that immunity.
Exactly. It's you're alluding a little bit to the second child syndrome as well. And that's the other thing. You just cannot keep your children, especially when they are the second ones, from picking up anything, wherever they have it from nursery, from older siblings. And you just need to relax a little bit about the fact that they will pick up something and they will make it through it, and it will actually make them healthier.
Is there any evidence to show that sort of second, third, fourth children are a little bit more healthier and a little bit more robust than their potentially mollycoddled older siblings?
Well, there is evidence that they pick up diseases a bit earlier in life, around 3 to 6 months, just because older sibling is bringing something home from nursery. And that actually makes them more robust once they enter nursery or reception class themselves. So firstborns are always a bit suffering from the clean home and the nice environment. And then once they enter the nursery or reception class, then it just hits them. Whereas the second one already made it through a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned animals and people, children growing up on farms tend to be a little bit healthier. I mean, my children have grown up with dogs. And I remember always feeling a little bit unsure when my daughter had a rice cake that she was eating, and then she'd sort of reach down and the dog would have a little nibble and then it would go back into her mouth. But that's not such a bad thing, is it?
No, absolutely not. And I mean, as long as animals live in our household, we share the same bacteria anyway. So the dog will run around and will lick at things, and we will touch the chair that the dog licked, and we will touch the food, and then we will put it into our mouth. So we can't avoid it. But also, our immune system is so smart that it will get used to it and will recognize the good bacteria that we picked up.
Isn't there some evidence to show that dogs' mouths contain less bacteria than our human mouths? Because our mouths are full of bacteria, aren't they?
Yes, and dog mouths are full of bacteria as well, just a bit different. And as you say, just a bit fewer.
Yeah, because I know that one thing, you know, when the child drops the dummy on the floor, a lot of parents then lick the dummy. But that's not a great thing, is it? Because our mouths are full of bacteria. Or is it a good thing? Is it a good way of exposing them to that?
It's actually a good thing because, again, our children, because we kiss them, we cuddle with them, them, they are used to the bacteria that we have in our mouth and everywhere else anyway. So it's actually a better way to disinfect a dummy than kind of putting it into chemicals.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I mean, you mentioned we've established it's good now for children to get a little bit ill. Obviously, you don't want them really badly ill because that is sort of tough, but hopefully you're sort of building up your immunity. What is normal in terms of coughs and colds and vomiting incidents? The sort of periods of time when your child is ill, what sort of normal would you say per year? I mean, you obviously see this a lot more than, than everyone else. What's your view on that?
So research says that if you have 8 illnesses throughout the whole year, then this is about the average. And then if it goes a lot above that, let's say 12 or 14 illnesses per year, then that would be a hint that something might not be right. So I always think that would be a good indicator to contact your GP and just have a look if there's any nutritional deficiency, for example, or if there's anything else that you would need to look into to boost the immune system.
And presumably children, as their immune system matures, get less ill. So this is presumably kind of normal for sort of 1, 2, 3, 4. But as they develop towards the age of 10, that should go down.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's really toddlers and any child starting daycare. So if you have a toddler and he was looked after by a nanny until he goes to reception class, then probably he will pick up a lot of things.
So obviously, you know, first thing on the list in terms of boosting our children's immunity is not being afraid to expose them to illnesses and to bacteria and to dirt and all of that. Obviously, there are other things that we can do as well. So vitamins is one thing. Giving their children vitamins is one thing that a lot of parents do. I remember my father, who's quite a cynical doctor, saying to me, if you have a balanced diet, all vitamin pills do is give you very expensive pee. And what's your view on that?
I tend to agree. I have to say the only vitamin that I'm quite enthusiastic about is vitamin D, just because we live inside most of the times, and vitamin D is known as the sunshine vitamin, so we really only produce it ourselves when we are exposed to sunshine, and that's at least 2 hours per day, and I don't think that any one of us really reaches that. So NHS and Public Health England, they recommend vitamin D substitution to anyone during the winter time and to all toddlers until the age of 4 throughout the whole year.
Okay. And what does vitamin D do for us? What would a person deficient in vitamin D suffer from?
Mm-hmm. So vitamin D is a really know-it-all, do-it-all vitamin. It's amazing. It helps our children to grow. It helps our babies for their brain development. But most importantly, it also supports our immune system by fighting especially respiratory tract infections. So there are loads of studies out there that have shown that if we take vitamin D during the winter time, our risk for having coughs, cold, bronchitis, all these things goes significantly down.
And so when you're choosing what vitamin to take, is there a big difference between the expensive ones and the cheaper ones? Or is vitamin D and that's bog standard, same thing?
Vitamin D is vitamin D, really. You just have to make sure that you take the right amount of vitamin D. And in that, some of the supplements vary. And the recommended dose for children would be 400 units per day.
And so we're talking children, what, under 12, under 16?
Until the age of 5.
Until the age of 5. And thereafter, they should still be taking vitamin D, but just not a higher dose, or?
They could take the same dose during the winter time. So that would be the recommendation then of NHS and Public Health England.
Okay, perfect. And other vitamins? Focus instead on a balanced diet? Is that what they're...
I think if you think about a balanced diet, then you get pretty much everything that you need. There are a lot of people who absolutely believe in vitamin C when they get a cold. But if you look at how much vitamin C we really need during the day, and that is for a toddler of maybe 3 years, that would be 50 milligrams per day. Mm-hmm. And you look how much vitamin C an orange contains, then mm-hmm. that's already 70 milligrams. Mm-hmm. So if you think about your diet and you mm-hmm. think about your daily required intake, then you meet it with a normal diet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you presumably absorb those vitamins better if you're getting them through a healthy diet rather than
exactly.
through a sort of sweetie vitamin thing.
Exactly. And maybe some other nutrients that I think about in a balanced diet is always iodine, folate and zinc, because they also support the immune system. And that is something that you find in dairy, for example, eggs, meat. So if you're vegan or vegetarian, or if you, for example, have a child that has a lactose intolerance or cannot drink milk for any other reasons, then that is something that you definitely should discuss with your dietitian.
Mm. And presumably then, if your child is going through a bout of illness and they just, you know, they just stop eating, don't they? You know, it can often be sort of a week where they just don't really eat that much. They might suck on a rice cake. Then presumably it might be worth seeing if they'll have a vitamin supplement, because at least if they can't eat, they're getting something.
Yeah. And I mean, also you don't do much harm with a vitamin supplement, and it gives you the feeling that you're doing something nice for your child. So the positive attitude and kind of being nice and reassured about it, that helps tremendously in healing.
There's a lot of talk in the media right now about gut health, mm-hmm. and the idea that our gut is the sort of brain of our body. And if the gut is healthy and contains lots of good bacteria, healthy bacteria, it has a huge effect on our sort of overall well-being. Is this something that you're getting excited about, this sort of the conversation around gut health?
Yes, absolutely. I'm completely enthusiastic about what we found out in the past few years, the things that have emerged, the gut-brain axis, how much the gut influences how we feel, and also the influence that the gut has on developing allergies and developing obesity. It's just fantastic what we're finding out, and it feels like we just tapped into a completely new world that is discovered a little bit every day.
Yeah. So what can we do to promote good gut health?
So mainly it would be important to think about having a big variety of different gut bacteria in your gut. So we know that the more depleted your gut bacteria variety is, the higher is our risk for developing diseases such as allergies, asthma. So the best thing you can really do about it is eating plenty of fiber. That's what we understand from the research at the moment.
I mean, breastfeeding is also really good, isn't it, in terms of cultivating mm-hmm. good bacteria. I was talking to a gastroenterologist, and he seemed to think that the way forward in terms of kind of maintaining good gut health is not necessarily to take probiotics, but to take tailored probiotics, because all mm-hmm. our gut makeup is all slightly different. Mm-hmm. And he says, as far as he can see, the only time we're getting tailored probiotics is through breastfeeding, because everyone's breast milk makeup is slightly different.
Yes. I mean, it's a magic potion, isn't it? It's just fantastic. So if you think about supplementing gut bacteria, you think about prebiotics and probiotics. So prebiotics are substances that we cannot necessarily digest, but our gut bacteria feed on. So that would be fiber, for example, or kind of small sugar molecules. And breast milk is just abundant in it. And then the other thing is probiotics, and that is just actual bacteria that we find in breast milk, but mm-hmm. also, for example, kefir, yogurt, kombucha.
Fermented foods,
exactly. And these are bacteria that will stay in our gut, and they will support the gut bacteria that we already have there.
Yeah. And these things are becoming much more widely available. And I definitely encourage your children to sort of try them, because actually the kombucha, it is a bit of an odd taste, but it's actually a very nice taste.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
A lot of children are very happy to drink that instead of apple juice.
Yeah.
And
you don't have to be worried about giving something that is not safe, because we know that the bacteria that you find in these fermented foods, they are safe for your children. The same goes for probiotic supplements. I mean, I know that the research out there is still not quite conclusive if they are really helpful as a supplement during the winter time, for example, to fight infections. But I always tell parents when I see them, it's just worth a try. And if it's not working for you, then it's not working for you. But there are parents out there, and it feels that it's working for them.
So this idea of our gut harboring very important healthy bacteria, I think for me, is very persuasive. Are there any other parts of the body where good bacteria live, or is it just the gut?
So bacteria live with us everywhere. They live on our skin, and they chase germs away that we don't want to have. They keep our skin intact, our skin barrier. They produce substances that protect our skin. And they live, everywhere else as well.
And is there anywhere else that they're particularly valuable? I mean, I was hearing something about sort of skin biome, and actually very often lots of use of sort of, constantly scrubbing yourself with soap isn't necessarily a good thing, because our skin naturally creates this perfect environment in which to thrive, and scrubbing it away with loads of strong astringent soap isn't very good for it.
Yeah, exactly. So if you think of teenagers suffering from acne, for example, they tend to vigorously clean their faces because they want the acne to go away. But really what they do is they promote the growth of bacteria that make the acne worse, whereas they take away the good bacteria that are very sensitive to all these cleaners that might actually protect you. So a lot of doctors would tell someone who suffers from acne to just stop all the cleaning products and kind of support the skin biome to protect your skin again.
Because, there's the idea too that, we all wash our hair quite frequently, and because it gets sort of dirty before. But actually, if you stop washing your hair completely, it sort of cleans itself, doesn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, yeah. I never wash my dog's coat, and her coat never gets greasy and sort of smelly. Yeah. My husband was actually working. He goes and lives with people that live in the middle of nowhere. And he lived with this lady who insisted on washing her hair with her own urine. And say that his hair felt amazing. I was like, you're not going to do that in my house. That's one thing in the woods.
It might be the urea that you found in the urine. And you actually also find it in a lot of skin creams.
Do you?
Yes. So
how interesting.
Have the body heal itself.
Well, and our bodies are so sophisticated. They're kind of they're way cleverer than we are understanding. Isn't that true? I mean, what interests me, when we talk in the bump class about how when babies are born, they're covered with this vernix, which is now known to be so good for your baby's skin. Like, we can't create anything like that, can we? Or colostrum, man can't recreate anything quite as wonderful or beneficial.
Not that we know of. I mean, we're trying to understand breast milk, and we're just discovering every day more substances that make breast milk so unique. And it's a real struggle for the formula companies to kind of reproduce that, because it is so difficult to find substances to kind of imitate these effects.
But that's also really reassuring that the formula companies are very sort of dedicated, because obviously there will be people listening that haven't been able to breastfeed their baby for one reason or another. And I think, God, being a mother, you're racked with guilt anyway.
Yeah.
That at least if you can't breastfeed your baby, it's not like you're feeding them something that's really terrible. It's something, in which a lot of care and money has gone into creating something that is as good as it possibly can be.
And it's work in progress, and it's something that is considered really, really safe, and that undergoes a lot of regulations. So I think if you can't breastfeed, then it is a safe and it is a good alternative.
In terms of gut health, one of the things I know isn't great for gut health is taking antibiotics, because that sort of tends to destroy all the bacteria, whether it's good or bad, in your gut. And obviously there are some situations in which, you're weighing up their risk benefit, and actually you do need to take antibiotics, because otherwise the risk is greater. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I mean, do you think antibiotics are potentially oversubscribed? People take them a little bit too soon?
Yes, I think. And I think the reason might be that now we want to have a quick fix for things. So we fear that if we just take the next pill, and if we just take the chemical stuff, then that will help us and that will make us feel better. When really, if you have a normal cold, it will just stay around for a week if you take the antibiotics or no.
And presumably, too, the more people take antibiotics, the more the resistance to them increases. So you're not only destroying your own gut bacteria, but if in 2 months' time you need to take them for actually a really significant infection, which they will cure, they might not be as effective.
Exactly. That's the other problem. And also, some people, they take antibiotics for 2 or 3 days and then they feel better and they stop them without really having cured the problem. And then that's really when you create resistances and when you make things actually worse.
It's really interesting what you say about rest, because I think that is a real problem for us in the 21st century. There's such pressure, and I see it the whole time, on people to be living their lives at 100 miles an hour, to be super productive. And, you know, we're constantly stimulated by screens. We're multitasking the whole time. And I'm sure that's having a profound effect on our mental health as a generation. Mm. But also this idea that if you get ill, the best cure often is just to rest.
Yeah.
And I know that might be inconvenient. And I know that might be that you have to cancel meetings. And it might even be a bit boring. But sometimes that's all you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, that must be quite frustrating advice to hear from a doctor, because they expect you to hand out the magic medicine.
Exactly. But sometimes it's a real struggle sometimes. And I also understand working parents. If you think about what I said earlier about the average amount of infections per year for a toddler would be 8 infections, which is potentially staying home with your child for 4 days or longer every single time, then this is a lot of work that you have to miss out on. So I do understand the pressure of wanting this magic potion, or to wanting to have this magic pill. But as you say, it sometimes just takes rest, and it takes a few days, and you need to give your body the time and the rest to recover as well.
Yeah. What about in alternative treatments, like sort of echinacea? What about sort of herbal remedies? Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence base behind those?
So evidence is coming up, and that's also something that I'm really, really happy about. I think herbal medicines have been a bit the orphan drugs of our times, because there's no one really backing them up, and there's no one conducting good trials around them to see why they are effective and if they are effective.
Because no one owns their patent and no one stands then to make money out of them.
Exactly. But I was quite happy to see that NHS just recently changed their guidelines around acute coughs. And they said the first thing you should actually do is take honey.
Okay. Honey in what form? Like dissolved in some milk or some water? Or
yes, as ever you wish it. So you can take a spoonful of pure honey. You can dissolve it in tea. You can dissolve it in lemon water. These are all the recommendations that they make. They also recommend echinacea, because you picked up on it, for children who are older than 12 years old, just because there are no other substances for them that they would be safe if they are younger than 12 year olds.
And how would you take that echinacea? Would you take it once the cough once the cold has started, or would you take it preventatively?
So you would rather take it once the cough has started, because it has been shown that the amount of episodes that you have of cough are reduced, and also the number of days that you feel ill are reduced.
Mm. And that may be that the fact that your brain knows that you're taking something, and people like to be doing something proactive to make you feel better. But I mean, I've certainly found anecdotally, from my experience, echinacea does make a difference. I don't know whether that's my brain telling me that I'm feeling better, or whether I am actually feeling better. But either way, I guess if it works, it's worth taking.
Or maybe it's a combination of both. You don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we do know, for example, in the case of honey, that it does contain antibacterial substances, for example. So we do know that there is something there that's helping. We just cannot pinpoint to the exact substance of what is helping which.
Do you know, I've started washing my face with honey. I have really sensitive skin. I'm really mm-hmm. prone to eczema, and it's made a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I started it was because, you know, I give my kids honey in their yogurt in the morning, and I'd often sort of be wiping my hands of it, and my hands would always feel really nice afterwards. So I thought, I'll just try it on my face. My daughter's really cross. She's like, Mummy, why are you stealing our honey? I was like, it's a hell of a lot less expensive than the expensive face washes that I was using.
Yeah, there are so many easy fixes, isn't it? The only thing with honey that you have to kind of look after is that you don't buy cheaper honey that is mixed up with any glucose syrups, because then obviously the potency of the honey will go down, but to use natural products.
So what are you looking for? Does it have to say on the product, this is actually mixed with glucose? You just look at the ingredients, do you?
Yeah,
just
sometimes it says that. Yeah, so it says glucose syrup.
Yeah, okay. So sort of natural honey is probably mm-hmm. what to look. I hadn't even realized that people would not sell honey that was part, you know, glucose mm-hmm. syrup. diet is obviously really important, isn't mm-hmm. it, in terms of maintaining sort of a healthy immune system. Are there any specific things we should be trying to get mm-hmm. our children to eating? Because, I mean, I really struggle getting my children to eat a variety of things. Mm-hmm. But what? How important is diet in maintaining a good, healthy immune system?
Diet is important. And I think the reassuring thing is that it's okay not to have a big variety in your diet. It's just a bit the question of what ingredients you will choose for your diet. So I think I'm a huge fan of dark, bitter vegetables such as broccoli, kale, because they are a really good combination of vitamin C, micronutrients like folate. They contain some iron. So if you have to choose one veg, I think take broccoli. Mm-hmm. Because it contains just a lot of different things.
Yeah. And obviously broccoli you can do in a sort of variety of different ways. Actually, I made a broccoli soup for my children, but, you know, I put a bit of milk in, I put a bit of butter, I put a potato in. So it wasn't that sort of really broccoli taste. It was a little bit easier for them to palate yeah. because they're not big broccoli fans, but yeah. at least they're eating that broccoli.
Exactly. And they're a nice finger food too. So you can just take the florets and steam them and take them on the go.
Yeah. Or dip them in something, you yeah. know, dip them in some hummus if that makes them sort of feel a little bit easier.
Yeah. And hummus is good as well because it contains chickpeas, and there you go again with iron and other proteins and good micronutrients.
And what about, I mean, other things like, I mean, sleep is presumably important for our overall health. Does it have an impact on our immune system?
Absolutely. And I think we realize ourselves when we have stressful times at work and we don't get a lot of good quality sleep, also because we lie awake at night, we're worried about things. We feel tired and we feel sick, and we're so much more prone to picking up something. And the same absolutely goes for our children as well.
Mm. I mean, I definitely find that sometimes when I feel I'm coming out down with something, I'll go to bed at literally 8:30 and mm-hmm. I'll sleep really well for 12 hours and I'll kind of wake up like a new woman. And I suppose being on the ball, if you feel your children are getting a bit tetchy, just trying to put them to bed a little bit earlier yeah. and seeing if that, I mean, by and large, I've sort of seen specialists say our children sleep slightly less nowadays than they did a generation mm-hmm. before. And I'm sure that's to do with there's a lot more pressure on children. There's yeah. clubs and there's school and there's homework. And but there's also screens yeah. which aren't very good at promoting sleep. So I guess just as parents, thinking about the amount of hours that your children are sleeping, looking at them, are they really struggling to wake up in the morning when the alarm goes off? If so, do they need to be in bed half an hour earlier, or even an hour earlier, or even one night a week they're in bed an hour earlier?
Yeah. And I think what you're mentioning is really important, that every child has their individual need of sleep. So you would say that on average a baby under 12 months, for example, sleeps around 14 hours, and then a toddler would sleep around 12 hours. But, you know, there are a lot of toddlers who are perfectly fine with only 8 hours of sleep. And then there are the other ones who just need a little bit longer. So I think it's a good idea to tune in with your child and have a look what mm-hmm. their needs are.
And I suppose also not setting in stone that bedtime, like bedtime is at 9 mm-hmm. because actually I find some weeks I'm just more tired and I need to go to bed earlier, and presumably that then translates to our children.
Exactly.
So it's more sort of teaching them to recognize when they're tired, or maybe one night a week just thinking I'm really going to invest in myself and go to sleep a little bit earlier and start yeah. that sort of wind down thing a little bit earlier, especially if they are mm-hmm. getting ill.
And if you think about prevention of infections, then making sure that your child gets a lot of sleep during the winter, that's, I think, one of the best things you can do.
Do we as humans need more sleep during the winter?
It's not necessarily during the winter, but I think just in winter, you have a higher risk of picking up something. So if you want to be extra safe during the flu time, then that would be a good thing to do.
And sleep is free. And gosh, it's free time for adults too, isn't it? So we shouldn't need to be persuading yes. our listeners. Exercise is obviously really important too. I mean, mm-hmm. I definitely feel that I sleep better when I exercise. I know that I feel better emotionally when I exercise. Presumably, it's good at sort of promoting that your immune system as well. Am I right? Is there evidence behind that?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're mentioning two things here. One is the emotional well-being.
Yeah.
And if we're happy and if we are not stressed, then our immune system feels better.
Yeah.
And that has something to do with the cortisol that we produce when we are stressed. And that suppresses our immune system and that makes us feel worse. So this is when we have a lot of stress at work, then we get ill more easily. So kind of exercising, feeling happy, that makes us feel better.
And getting out to stores, ideally, to do some exercise.
Yes, exactly. That's the other thing. So being outdoors, getting rid of all the germs that we picked up inside, having fresh air, being away from the dry air that we have because of the heating inside. That's a big thing as well.
Perfect. Well, and, you know, for children, that's obviously not joining a gym class, but even going for a bike around the park or
exactly.
going for a walk or climbing a tree or just having a game of tag outside. It doesn't need to be necessarily hours and hours of it, but a little bit every day is really walking to school.
And even if your little one is ill, a walk outside, maybe not making him walk around or run around, but maybe having him kind of cuddle up in the pram, It's really, really helpful and beneficial.
Because people are scared about going outside when they, especially when they've got a cold. There's this idea that being cold gives you a cold and being cold makes your cold worse. I mean, that's absolutely not true, is it?
It's absolutely not true, no. I mean, there are some reasons why we are more prone to pick up something in the winter, because the viruses are around, because the viruses feel better when they are in colder air. But really, the reason why we pick them up is because we are around other people and we are around more people insides than outsides, really. So don't be afraid to go outside. It's a beneficial thing. It's really a good thing.
So your child did not get a cold for swimming in a cold pool. Your child got a cold because they came in contact with someone who has a virus.
That's it.
Yeah. And if your child has got a cold, actually wrapping them up nice and warm, but taking them outside for a short period of time, either in their buggy or for a little sort of gentle walk, is going to be a good thing as opposed to a bad thing.
Exactly. Or just, you know, having a break on the balcony, opening the window, just getting this dry air out and getting a bit of moist air inside is really helpful for our airways.
Okay, good. Well, that, because that is a big myth that is perpetuated by lots and lots and lots of people.
I know, it drives me crazy as well.
We need to rebrand the cold exactly as a virus, because people think it is to do with the cold. Okay, just a few scenarios that I thought I'd just ask you while I have you here. There's an outbreak of norovirus in your school. Are you going to do anything different in terms of trying to prevent your child from getting it? What would you do?
So definitely talk to my child about washing hands. So I think that's something that I would encourage more during times of outbreaks of any kind of virus, especially norovirus, because it's a really painful one to have yourself.
Mm. And highly contagious, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So after before putting your hands into your mouth, before eating, after touching any surfaces, especially after going to the bathrooms, you have to wash your hands. And ideally, you would dry your hands either with your own towel at home, or with a paper towel, or you would just use the blow dry.
Yeah, yeah. And if there is a child, because often there isn't a blow dry and there's a sort of towel, you know, wiping them on their trousers, is that kind of better than doing a sort of communal towel wipe?
Yeah, so it would still be better. Probably the norovirus might already be sitting on the trousers, but it might not. Whereas in the towel, you will for sure find it.
Yeah. And I suppose also discouraging them from putting their fingers in their mouth the whole time, which, you know, children do. They, you know, suck their thumb. But if you can explain it to them, just please try and not put your fingers in the mouth. Try not to eat your food with your fingers. Use your knife and fork.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's really important. And then obviously the school are kind of quite good at saying to people, if your child has had vomiting and diarrhea, to stay away from school. But it's got to be for 48 hours, doesn't it? Since last episode.
Exactly. So that's 48 hours after the last episode of diarrhea.
So it's not that, you know, your child vomited in the night, but they're fine in the morning, so they can go to school, because mummy, quite frankly, needs to go to work. It, you know,
exactly.
It is really
there we
important.
Go with the struggle again. Yeah.
Yeah, quite important. How about, is there, I mean, we've talked about a lot of the things we can do, but is there anything specific you do to try and prevent this, make your child a bit more resilient to getting colds?
Yeah, I think the points that we talked about is getting enough sleep, taking a vitamin D supplement, making sure that you have a balanced diet. I think these are really the things that I would encourage the most.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that diet is very much a sort of theme running through this sort of overall health, and, you know, it makes us healthier and strong. And this is kind of part of your venture. So you've created a baby food company. Do you want to just tell me a bit about why you created what you've created and why it's different?
So we created Little Tummy about 1.5 years ago. And the reason we founded the company is that we found that the commonly available baby food in the supermarkets really doesn't reflect on our preferences of what we would like to eat, and it also doesn't reflect on what babies actually should be eating. So I saw a lot of parents in the practice that I used to work at, and they asked me what kind of baby food brand I would recommend, and I could really not recommend any, because the problem with them is baby food is highly heat processed. So what it does, it prolongs the shelf life. So you can keep the baby food up to 2 years in your shelf. So some baby food is older than your baby. But on the other hand, it destroys all the nice micronutrients, the vitamins, the fiber, the authentic taste and texture. And I mean, if you've ever tasted one of the pouches yourself, then you will see that it really doesn't taste like what it claims on the outside. So I was really happy when my co-founder Nadine approached me and she said, look, I have this really innovative processing technique with cold pressure, similar to what you use for juices at the moment, which kind of kills off all the bacteria, so the food will be safe. But on the other hand, you will preserve all the micronutrients, the vitamins, the fiber, and the food really does taste as if you just made it yourself. So that was a big opportunity for me to bring out healthy food to parents' doorsteps. And we've worked on developing the recipes since then, which meet all the nutritional requirements. So we do use a lot of vegetables. We use a lot of pulses, lentils, and we're going to launch in April. So it's really exciting for
us. Fantastic. Well, I know from my experience when my children were little, I did make as much of food as I could, but there were times when I couldn't, and there were times that I needed to give myself a break. And you're right, there was some of the stuff, especially the stuff with protein in, I found actually really disgusting. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, oh, why did I spoil him with all this homemade food? I should have just given him this processed food from day one. But that's obviously completely the wrong sentiment. So
yeah, it's so important to get our babies used to authentic taste from the very beginning. So if your baby understands that broccoli, kale, veggies, pulses, lentils, fruit is just something that we eat in the family, and they know the taste from the very beginning, then this is something that they will just readily accept into their older ages. And probably your children don't have a problem with making healthy food choices until now.
Well, no, they're pretty good. They eat pretty healthy. I think we all eat pretty healthy as a family. And you sort of model that behavior on your children. I'm struggling with the variety because they love like poached chicken and rice and lentils, which is really not that bad, but that's kind of all they eat. But so I was reading somewhere that, you know, ideally you should have introduced every taste there is by the time your child's a year old.
Yeah, that's absolutely
because they
right.
can sort of deal with it. Yeah. And then they're much more bolder because, you know, a lot of children just only want that same food that they've had again and again. They're not very adventurous when it comes to tasting. Yeah. And
it's something that we call neophobia in child development. So it means that children, once they turn 1 year old, they are afraid of new things because they learn what it is to be in an environment that they know and that they feel safe in. And they know that things that are unfamiliar might be unsafe. So it's a natural reaction. And anything that we introduce to them before they turned a year old just kind of goes into the world of the known to them.
So you've got this window of opportunity, which you have to use.
Yeah. On the other hand, we do like sweet taste from the very beginning. So a baby will always prefer eating a banana over eating broccoli. But if we're just persistent and we try hard enough and often enough, then a baby will eventually accept a more bitter taste.
Well, it is. I mean, I do find with the sugar, you know, you wean yourself off sugar and you need it much less. Whereas if you're used to eating lots of sugar, you crave it much more. And I suppose when you've got a baby, you've got ultimate control. They can't open up the drawer. They can't go to the newsagent and buy themselves a Kit Kat.
Yeah.
You know, so you have this opportunity to be able to monitor how much sugar they eat and sort of give that kind of good investment. And listen, when they are eight, they are going to go trick-or-treating and eat their body weight in sweets. And that's sort of part and parcel of being a parent. But at least when you've got that control, you might as well make the most of it.
Exactly. And I think the most important thing is to know that it's okay that they do trick and treat. They shouldn't do it every single day, but it's okay to treat yourself from time to time because that's what we do, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. We all fall off the wagon at some stage. And as long as we then have a healthy week after an unhealthy week, that's probably not such a bad thing. Thank you so much. So Little Tummy, where can people find out more about what you're doing?
The best is to have a look on our website, littletummy.co.
Okay.
And we also have a blog, and you can find all kinds of information around healthy diet for your baby there as well.
Yeah, well, I've read some of your articles and they're really good, which is exactly why I got you to come along today.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me.
That's a pleasure. It's been so great talking to you. So illuminating. And I feel really positive, actually. I know that we've sort of ended the flu season, but, you know, it'll be around before I know it. So thank you so much. Thank you all for listening to another episode of The Parenthood. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate and review us, and do spread the word amongst your friends. But in the meantime, I hope we've given you some food for thought. Thank you for your time. And from Sophie and me, goodbye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.